Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with singer, dancer, actor, writer, producer, director, Joel King. The West Coast Black Theater Troupe produced a one-day workshop of his extraordinary hip-hopera called Real Life. In addition to hearing the extraordinary story of the development of this multi-talented man, you will hear him talk about the etiology of real life. So hang on, here come the show. Person you really are. And the interview that I'm airing today is with a man who is so very definitely who he really is. So many of us are discouraged from discovering all that we are, all that we can be, all that is possible for us. Joel King was fortunate that he not only has a remarkable toolbox of skills, but he was able to discover them naturally, easily, and he was encouraged to develop them. This is rare and wonderful and inspirational to listen to. So here now is the very lucky, very talented Joel King. So I'm here with Joel King, and you have seen Joel here. You saw him in the Sam Cooke story. Mm-hmm. And
Knock Me a Kiss, Full of Purple, Bonk.
Yes, you have seen Joel. every season. You've seen Joel in everything, right? And we are looking forward to seeing Joel in things to come.
Yes.
Okay, so I interview people who make their living or their life within art.
Yes.
And the art to which you are giving your life, would you say theater? Would you say music? Would you say acting? What would you say?
Ooh, you know, people tend to call me a Renaissance man because it gets kind of hard to describe it.
Yes, yes, yes,
you know,
yes.
It's very seasonal for me. Like, there are moments when it'll just be performing, and whether it's film performance or it's stage performance, and then there are moments where I'm like in charge of it all, where I'm either producing it, directing it, or writing.
Oh my goodness.
Next. So yes, it's like, it's this beautiful pot.
Yes.
But a nice meal when
yeah. Okay. So it's singing, it's dancing, it's acting, it's directing, it's producing, everything that, and it's film and theater. Mm-hmm. So really, yeah, I think Renaissance man.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, so I only ask one question.
Yes.
And it is, do you remember the first moment in your life when you were drawn to singing or dancing or acting or stories or any of that stuff?
Yes.
You do?
I do.
Okay, tell me.
I do. I knew myself as a visual artist first. I just knew that I knew how to do it.
Okay, so visual artist, meaning that you drew?
Yeah.
Then let's start at the beginning. When did that start?
I was 4 years old.
Yeah.
And my older sister, Shannon, used to draw. And so she would pull me to the side. That was like our quality time. And I would just do what I saw on the paper. And had no idea that it was something that was special to anybody. And I was doing what I do. Mm-hmm. And so it was not until I went to elementary school more people started to praise this, and I recognized, like, oh, I got something working here, so let me keep this moving. And then, so my brain was really in that. I grew up in the church, so I sang in the choirs, and my father is a choral director, and was vicious. Vicious. Alto, soprano, sing!
Slave driver.
Yes, 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 but people loved him, and they respected him for it, mm-hmm. You know.
So wait, I just want to stop because it seems to me that much as when you started to draw, you didn't know that was any big deal. It was just something you did.
Absolutely.
When you started to sing, you also didn't think it was any big deal. It was just something you did.
You did, right. So, and then when I started to write, again, not knowing that it was any big deal.
Well, how did that happen?
That happened in my church. My uncle knew a lot of prominent people, and he would tend to invite them to the church and sing and all that. And one lady, she and I would talk a lot about, you know, the future and what would happen. At this time, I'm about 12 years old, and so I had remember this black and white composition book, and I started writing my first play.
At 12?
At 12, yeah.
Because she stimulated this in you.
She did. Now, I'm familiar with myself as a visual artist. I've learned that I can sing. And then there was that moment in elementary school for the first question.
Uh-huh.
I saw my school, Dunmore Elementary School, used to bring in different groups from different schools to perform for us. And I just remember what it did to me. I said, I don't know what this all means. I don't even know that I want to do it. I just know that I'm fascinated by what I see. I was in the fifth grade, so I was like 10 years old. I was invited to Roosevelt High School, and they were doing the Black Nativity. And they were just rehearsing at this time. And I remember this girl singing so beautifully, and this guy. And I was all busy in my seat, but then it set me down. It created a calm. And again, I was intrigued. I'm like, oh my God. And I remember saying to myself, like, I want to do this one day. I remember when they invited a gentleman to sing for us. He was just a soloist. And I said, man, I want to come back and do that one day. You know? And it was just a crazy thing because as life continued to happen, I did exactly what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Well, what's so interesting to me is everything you saw.
Mm-hmm.
That spoke to you, right?
Yes.
Right? And everything spoke to you.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yes. And, you know, and Did you tell anybody this? Did you tell your sister Shannon or your parents that you were interested in any of this? Or you just, it's all going on inside you?
It's all going on inside me. I did study some classical music.
On some instrument?
Vocally.
Oh, yeah. Really? Mm-hmm. When?
When I was in college, I took a few vocals. When I was in middle school, I had to sing Balm and Gilead. So I started singing, and then I realized that, there you go, you have some, again, you have something different, mm-hmm. right? And it wasn't really recognized among my peers because to me it sounded like an old man up there. To them it sounded like an old man up there singing, like what kids are gonna, you know, got all that roundness and richness to his tone, it doesn't make sense. But it was my teachers that pulled me to the side and say, let me help build this. And that's...
That was in middle school.
And then went to high school, and that teacher, she drilled it, pulled me to the side. Even when we didn't have class, came here, I want to work with you. Even when she was mad at me, came here, I want to work with you.
So this was a music teacher in middle school and a music teacher in high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because by this time I pretty much had dropped the visual arts.
Right.
Yeah, and so now I'm spending my time trying to learn myself as a singer.
Yeah, okay. So are you thinking in high school what you want to do or what you want to be?
I wanted to sing.
You wanted to sing,
right.
That
was my thing.
Okay. You were incredibly fortunate in all kinds of ways. I mean, you came with the stuff.
Absolutely.
But you got all this encouragement.
Absolutely.
You know, all of your influences worked for you.
Yeah, oh my God.
It's amazing. I mean, there's nobody saying, no, don't, why, none of that is happening.
I had a moment of that, though.
Oh, did you? Tell me.
I did. My mom was very attracted to the idea of me being an architectural engineer because she knew of my skill.
The visual skills.
I had this crazy passion for homes and designs and things.
See.
So she was like, you know, we need to make sure building the nest eggs. I went to school, so I'm a little clever, I would say. So I said, I went to school for art and design.
Now, I know you must have known from the beginning what your mother wanted you to be.
Absolutely.
Did you say to her, but what about singing? Could I, because I'd like to sing? Or you didn't even bother with that?
I think if I can recall correctly, I didn't even bother with
it. No, because you knew.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So in order to placate mommy, mm-hmm. you say, I'll major in art and design.
I'll major in art and design, and I'll minor in music.
I'll minor in music.
And then comes the other addition to the story.
Yeah.
Because they had the late Lisa Colbert Bandelli formed this thing called the Black Theater Workshop at SIUE, the school that I graduated from.
Ah.
And so the Black Theater Workshop was, they didn't have a lot of shows that catered to the black students there, so we created it.
This isn't a black school?
No, SIU, Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville.
Right, okay. Right. Mm-hmm. So this woman is a teacher at the school?
Yeah.
And she's a black woman?
She's a black woman.
And she says, well, let me do something here for the black students,
absolutely.
Right? And she creates this
Black Theater Workshop. And the
amazing.
Yeah, and they got behind her. And it was, at the time,
Just ironically,
absolutely.
You happened to be there.
Right, because again, my mind's still music. My first thing was, because my first professional gig, right before going into college, I auditioned for an opera, Joshua Boots. Got called back for the main role, but I did not get the main part, but they wanted me.
Mm-hmm.
I said, we don't know exactly where to put you. Find a place for it. So I end up doing that. So my mind's thinking still the music. So I go into this program, Black Theater Workshop. Even when I did the audition, I'm auditioning singing spirituals.
Right, right. You're going to be, right, yeah.
And then they give me some parts to learn for acting.
And son of a gun, you discover that you have that skill. Right?
I'm like, okay. This is some masterpiece that God's put together. I don't understand. And, you know, it all makes sense later on.
Okay, so wait. I have a question.
Yes.
Up until now,
mm-hmm.
you haven't had any training.
Right.
You haven't studied art. You haven't studied singing. You haven't studied dancing. You haven't studied acting.
Right.
Is this correct?
Well, we're talking about college?
No, before college. Nothing, right?
Right.
So then you get into college, and this woman creates this black theater troupe.
Yes.
And you audition, and now you're in a theater troupe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, and now...
And you're getting some training musically. What are you getting, instrumental training?
No, so musically, like to give proper credit, because my teachers were diligent the way that they were back in middle school and high school, they would tend to pull me to the side. So right. Technically that's
where, a little more training.
Yes.
Right, right.
That's where a lot of it came
but
from.
Not official training. You didn't...
It wasn't a private class where it was
just an instructor. Yeah, no, this was just a gift.
Right, yes. Absolutely, yes.
Right.
And that they helped me fine-tune it.
Yeah, right.
Even in preparation for
right,
this.
So you already had some idea about technique.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, yes. Good. So you do the spirituals, they say, good, we want you, and now you're in this thing, yeah. And they get you a part.
Yeah. And so I read, and I always had an interest. You know, we talked about it. I had an interest in theater. I mean, I wanted
to. Well, no, you had an interest in stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I wanted to find, you know, but I never had the opportunity to do it. So right. Now I've given the opportunity, and after it gets done, both professors, Lisa and Bill Grivner, pulled me to the side and say, we need to talk to you for a second. They pulled me into her room and they said, what is your interest in majoring in theater? I said, well, I really don't have an interest in majoring in theater. They said, what about you minoring in it? I said, okay, what about it? So I said, if you take 5 classes, you get a minor. That's all you need to do. I said, because you have something and we want to help be a part of what Bill
unbelievable.
Does. Yeah.
You're the poster child for how it's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, really. Okay, yes. So you say, all right, I'll take 5 classes in theater, and I'll have a minor in theater. Are you still going to have a minor in music?
Still minor in music, minor in theater, and a major in art.
And now you're still an art and design major?
Still an art design major.
Are you liking it?
I'm liking it, but I'm loving the theater. I'm like, oh my God, this is great. You know, and if I'm to be completely truthful,
yes,
it was my most vulnerable moment in my life because I learned myself in ways that I just did not know. And that's when I learned the beauty of theater. And I would tell people to this day, everyone needs to experience it. Everyone needs a different script in their hand just so they can be free telling their story, but in a different way. Because my belief is that even when we come to the stage, no matter what character we're bringing a part of ourselves, you know. And the only way you can best examine and exemplify what that's on a piece of paper if you open yourself to those things that are really inside.
If you find it in you.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that scared my mom. So with her story, because she only had it for a moment. And what created that, the very first show that I did outside of the school, mm-hmm. I did The Dutchman, and it was, I was this sophisticated black gentleman who was on this train riding with a younger white woman, and everything was good, but she continued with she had a salacious, you know, way of
she approaching. She kept coming on you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then and was also degrading with her words. So, at this moment, I was fed up. I was fed up. I was ready. Mama think I'm about to sing a Negro spiritual, but I cussed that girl out so good. She, and all I heard in the back was, I heard, I said, oh my God. So when I got done with it, you know, my mom, what you think? Don't touch me. Oh, don't touch me. Don't touch me.
Yeah, right.
So then after that, she and I sat down. I remember this like it was yesterday. We were in the car outside of the on the parking lot of the university. And she said, Joel, I just don't know about this for you. Because I wonder how your niece and your nephews will take you seeing this type of stuff. And my dad was one of my major cheerleaders because he saw life in a different way. Both of them were very, like, very religiously rooted, but he had a different appeal during that time that she was still working to discover. And he's like,
I just love that. Yeah. I love what you just said. What she was working to discover.
Yeah.
So that it's such a lovely way to say that she was stuck.
Yeah.
You know, in an old way of thinking.
Absolutely.
Right? And that you at least believed that she was going to evolve into a larger
absolutely.
Perspective, right?
Yeah.
It's very sweet. I don't know whether she actually did it, but it's clear.
She has one of the strongest supporters, if not the strongest supporters that I have to this day. And so she dad talked to her, like, baby, you got to know that what you see on stage, that is left on stage. You know, that's not who your son is. And the more she saw that, I think she became more open. And then I had to get clever again.
Okay, wait. I just want to make sure I have the chronology here. Because I think we jumped a little bit.
Okay.
When you did The Dutchman, yes. Were you still in school?
I was still in school.
Oh, you're still in school. So that was the first play you did
outside of
in part of the troupe.
It was a major thing, yeah. Outside of the troupe. Everything prior to that was all about Black Theater Workshop. Anything that was connected, even like when we were invited to do things outside of the school, still connected to Black Theater Workshop.
Okay, so you had a lot of experience in the Black Theater Workshop in plays.
In plays.
Plays, straight plays and musicals.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But then you got this opportunity to do this other thing. How did that happen?
He had come to the Black Theater Workshop. He had seen my work and said, I want you to come and read for this part. So I ended up getting
the
part. Wow.
So yet again, Deus Ex Machina. I mean, you know, he comes and gets you, pulls you out, drops you into this thing, right?
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely, yeah.
Right. And it's interesting. So your mother didn't get to see any of the Black Theater Workshop stuff? This is the first thing she saw?
No, she saw some of the Black Theater. But Black Theater Workshop, what they did was a compilation of different shows. So you had the tone of it was very family-oriented.
Yeah, right. I got it. Right. Yeah. So this is the first time she got to see you play somebody or not.
And plus I was singing spirituals and things like that. Right. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Okay. So what happens then?
So dad talks to her and she becomes more open. So I was like, okay. So let me find a way to satisfy mommy. I got an opportunity for my a professional show doing Tambourines to Glory. I said, I think it was by, I think Tambourines to Glory was by Langston Hughes, if I'm not mistaken. She loved it. That's what I'm talking about, Jordan. So strike, yeah. So then after that, I did Bubbling Brown Sugar, and then everything else came, like, that made her sad. But then, after I got graduated from college, I started getting more into this writing thing. So that's another story.
Yeah, no, well, I want to hear that story.
Yeah, I a friend of mine, one of my besties, we were, like, attached to the hip doing different things in the theater program. So when I graduated and everything, when I say everything got away from me, was starting to get away from me, like, I had lost my job. I was a music teacher at a school in Alton, Illinois.
Oh, let's stop here. So when you graduated, you got a job teaching? Is that what you're saying?
No, I was actually a teacher while I was in school.
You got a job teaching while you were in school?
Yeah, but at a private school.
To make a little money?
Hmm? To make a little money.
Right, okay.
And I, which is, again, I'm learning other things about myself because
right.
I was responsible for putting on a show, a spring and a winter show. And
so you're learning the production skills now,
absolutely.
Right? Right, and probably the directing skills.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, everything was just coming
together. Falls into play. What does he need now?
All right.
Okay, we'll give him that. All right.
And I mean, and it went over the very first year I did it so well that they had pretty much had eliminated the program after I left, but because the parents were so excited about what they saw, they said, we just cannot just let them go. So they rallied up, found additional money within the body of parents to bring me back and bring me back at a higher salary.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I worked hard to put on another show and give them exactly what they needed, and they were fascinated. They had a winter show and a spring show, and I really, it's like what you're saying, I realized what it was that I possessed, because they didn't have a theater, they had an auditorium,
mm-hmm.
So I had to find this way. Now I'm learning how it's all come together, because
yes.
Visually, how do you construct a show with nothing.
Right.
So I went, hey, you guys got lights. Let's bring in disco lights. Let's bring in this. I grabbed some costumes from...
oh, my God.
Yeah, and the kids were fantastic. It was raved, just completely raved. And that... So I'm like, okay, I
can do this.
Oh, right. Right. So, again, I'm learning something else.
Oh,
right.
Oh, my God.
You know.
Okay, and by this time, you're not even 21 years old.
No.
My goodness. Okay, so... You graduate,
mm-hmm.
And then what happens?
By this time, I'm 23. Mm-hmm. Or about to turn 23. And I'm living with my friend. We had like this townhome in the county. And she and I had just decided, like, we got to give this up because, you know, it's becoming too much of a financial burden. So I said, what else do we do? So I woke up. I said, you know what? I want us to make some money. So I grabbed a script that I wrote when I was 16 years old.
Oh, my God.
So I wrote one when I was 12, and I wrote another when I was 16 called Faith. I remember that exactly because when I was an accountant, an internship as an accountant. When I was 15, I remember using their computer and their, sorry, Lantern Trucking, but thank you. But I used their paper, used their time. Anytime they gave me free, I was writing scripts. So anyway, I went and I grabbed the script and said, you know what, this is what we need to do. But then, going back to inspiration, my high school teacher, she performed this monologue. It was about this mother who was burned in this, trying to save her daughter. And she was left with the scars from it. And as a result, the daughter had a foul way of appreciating her mother. And so as she was going to pick her up from college, and the daughter was distancing herself, so she did not have to introduce her mother or let people know about their connection. And so the monologue came, and the monologue was so beautiful and inspirational. So I was inspired when I was 15 to start on that. And when I was 23, I pulled it out. I'm saying, you know, because by this time I'm more developed in my skill.
Yeah.
Like I've been around it enough, and I'm learning that, oh, there are different ways to structure writing and songs, da, da, da. So I started putting it all together in a different way. And then came A Mother's Cry. And so we put it on as our way to make money.
Where did you put it on?
At a church. My church.
Of course.
That I had grown up. Yeah. And the funny, I'm going to tell you the interesting about this. Because I probably should put this information out there, but it's totally fine. We did a voluntary eviction. So we pretty much moved everything out, you know, because, again, we knew that we probably would not be able to
afford it. Right.
Only thing I left there were my things in the basement that I was using to work. I had my computer, I had a television, I had a bed. So every morning I would get up, I'd start writing, da-da-da. So this morning, this particular day, we were at the church getting things together for the show. I had to go back home and grab a few things. I knew that I had 10 days. I didn't know within 10 days, but
yeah,
I thought at the 10th day, that's when it had to be over. So I'll go back to the house to pick up some things for the show. And I go park in the back, come around to the front, and there are people scattered all across my things like roaches. I was like, oh, that's my stuff. They jump in cars with televisions on the back, computers, all that. And I just remember I went into some world. I don't even know what it was. I just remember just smiling and turning into a circle. Because I think what was going on, the other part that enjoys stories.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this is
a great story.
You know, perhaps what I don't exactly want to tell, but I mean, it's part of my life. So I go back and I pick up what I can pick up from it. And mind you, I think either rehearsal or something for that. So I've got to clean this mess up from on the front lawn, the thing, retrieve what I can retrieve, and then get back to rehearsal to deal with the folks there.
Oh, my God.
Not to mention there were friends that had seen this, because I'd never been evicted before. So to see that, and that feeling was just like,
that's right.
This was traumatic. Yeah. But, yeah, so then we did the show. The show went over very well. And very well in the sense that people received it well.
Right.
But there were a lot of production things that, like, oh, my God, you know, that we could have done differently. But it got a great review, so much to where there was a company that picked it up, like, almost, like, immediately after. It was a smaller playhouse and totally on the other side, like a West County versus, like, East Side. It was great. So they put it on, and then from there came someone else that was interested, and then someone else.
Oh, my God, so you're a playwright.
I'm a playwright, right. Woo! And so then they were like, they were saying, you got to find ways to create your stories, but tell them, like, condense your stories, because they're require a lot of people, and it's not as attractive.
And it's too expensive to put this stuff on.
Absolutely.
Right.
So then I go, and I'm working at Sprint during this time. This is in 2000.
So you just keep getting jobs to pay for your habit,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. Right?
Absolutely.
Right.
That's really what it was.
Yeah.
I mean, because I remember writing one of my shows, Meeting at the Elder Circle. I was a host at Sprint at this time. And so the lady come in, and my line for everyone, hello, welcome to Sprint. And because I was so, like, immersed into this show, I was like, hallelujah, welcome to Sprint. Oh, shoot. Joy, you got to get away from this. You got to get away. So, yeah, so a lot of things were birthed in those type of surroundings. And I just kept paying attention. Something would come and say, what am I supposed to do with this? So I will go, and I will travel to different places that I was led to do my study. Or a different place I just ended up.
Right.
Which is how real life was even birthed. Because something about that 2003 or 2005 year, a lot of things were just like, I was fueled. Because 2004 was the birth of real life. And that happened because I was a camp counselor at the time. Again, feeding my habit in some way, trying to survive. And I remember this young man saying to me, we were at the Arch. So he said, they were acting up, and I said, hey, guys, get it together. We are in a public establishment. Act proper. And the young man says, so you want us to act white?
Ooh.
I said, oh, my God. I said, no, I want you to act proper. Behave yourself as you should in a public establishment. So that was mark one.
And okay, then, now wait a minute. Who are these people?
These are like little 11, 10-year-olds that I was responsible for.
Ah, yes.
They had set like a four. All this stuff is so intentional, so, you know, divinely
yes,
intentional.
Yeah, yeah.
There were four little guys that wrote my next story and didn't even know that was happening. So it hit me when he said that. I'm like, what?
Right.
You know? So then we go outside, and they were so comical, too. Like, dude, they had so much personality. So there were, you know, people walking around, and so when there was someone white, they would
straighten up,
you know, and respond in a different way.
Wow.
But then when someone black would come around, so someone of color, there was more, just more relaxed, more, you know.
Right.
I said, okay. I said, you guys, y'all got to figure this out. This is like no good. He said, man, look, he said, I ain't never leaving the ghetto. Because
this is an 11-year-old?
This is an 11-year-old.
Oh, my.
I ain't never leaving the ghetto because I leave the ghetto, I'll be selling out to my community.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, what? I said, do you believe that? He said, yeah, I believe that. I said, oh, wow. And then there's one little guy who you could tell was like a follower. He chimes in.
Yeah,
he
right.
wants to.
Me like, too.
Yeah, me too. I'm like, what the heck is going on? And I think, so I started to gain more information. I started putting some things on paper. And the thing that really hit me the most, I was a substitute teacher during this time for eighth grade class. This girl said to me, no, she just blurted out in class, I was raped by my father.
Oy.
No, she said, I want to kill my father.
Yeah.
I said, excuse me, I want to kill my father. I said, why? She said, because he raped me. And I said, wow. And the thing that hit me the most, not the information that came out of her mouth, but the response that she had.
That she wanted to kill him.
That was what came out
right,
verbally.
Right, right, right.
Her action was something that was very immune.
Yeah.
And then to know that information was just presented to the classroom and no one responded to that.
Right.
No one responded to her cry at all.
Yeah.
I said, oh, wow. So let's put pen to paper, Joel. Let's figure out a way to tell the story, but heal the story. Because I think one of the things that happened, and I've learned that was, because when I first did the show, I said I just wanted to put it out there. Let it be like gut-wrenching, you know, because this is how some people wake up every morning and how they go to sleep.
Right.
You know.
This is their life.
This is their life. And everything is not a happy ending. So I said, why do I need to
make a happy ending?
Right. So that was my initial thought. But then I said, I would go as far as say God spoke. And saying, my purpose is about to resolve. When I call myself conscious theater, mm-hmm. because the idea is to create thought. Because if there's no sense of solution, the only thing you're doing is just giving them, sitting someone down for 2 hours just to let them know how horrible their life really is.
Right.
But there's a way to derail this. And the way to do that is to present not a fantasy of a solution, but the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the central character for this show. His name is Ray.
Is this real life?
This is real life.
Mm-hmm.
Real life. He's dealing with what I think we all have come to. We come to that wall in our life, and we don't know if it's left or right, which is the next move.
Mm-hmm.
And some people stay standing at that wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the wall gives you nothing but nothing. And that's exactly what was going on with him. So he said, I feel trapped. He says this, like my mind is trapped because I don't know what the next move is. So then you start choosing something, you know, and it has nothing to do with the clear path. It's just something.
It's a choice.
It's a choice.
Just move.
Right. So he started moving. And then in that move, it causes this spiral effect of chaos. And then you're trying to reason with chaos. Until you have that pivotal moment that says, I got this in a different way. And that's exactly what happened to him. He figured he had it in a different way. But he had to realize what he had to connect. Just like I had to realize, like, this art, this writing, this performance, I'm supposed to be a producer. I'm supposed to be a director. You know, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Because all that makes sense. So with him, the same thing. You're supposed to be a father. You're supposed to be a worker. You're supposed to give back to the people who have poured into you. That's what you're supposed to be, you know. And that's what healed us. That's what healed forgiveness. It goes back to that story. Like faith in whatever the belief is, it's a real thing, you know. If you don't connect, if you don't align your truth to something, to something or someone, you know, you're going to find yourself, I think, at that wall more times than not.
Okay, so really, you're you're not just a storyteller, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have a point of view, you have
a
message, you have a mission.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And everything you do, or at least everything you write, comes from that perspective.
Absolutely.
Right. So I'm sorry that you're not getting to see real life because I'm sure it's terrific. So, okay, so now we have you out of college,
mm-hmm.
And already making a name for yourself as a playwright.
Yeah.
And so what happens?
Well, I get to this point. I think I found my wall.
Mm.
You know?
Ah.
And because the wall came early, because you have people that are interested in promoting you. They see you as an actor. They see you as a writer. They're interested in how do we move you to the next level. So I have my different friends, my besties that insert themselves into, and I'll allow it. Mm-hmm. Joel, you need to be doing this. You need to be doing this.
No, everybody has an opinion.
Yeah. You know, and one of my friends, she went as far to say, I will pay for you to come to California, because she had interest in going to California as well. So she said, you just come, why don't you live with me, and we'll figure this thing out. And that's exactly what we did. And I was out there for about 6 months. And the thing that was weird, we were living with someone on the floor, and then birthed other pieces. I said, man, I did this show called Through the Eyes while I was out there. And that was based on my mom's story. I said, Mom, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. So I started talking to her, and it was by accident. I just asked her to tell me about the story of my older sister that passed away when I was one. Like, because I had no idea of it until I was like 7 years old. And I wanted to know, what I did learn was that her death was connected to a lot of the transition that happened in the home. And, like, we had moved from this two, I come from a huge family.
Ah.
It's 11 of us, with 10 of us still living.
My goodness.
Yeah, so at that time, my older sister passed away. It was 9 of us in a two-bedroom home. Yeah. And they were getting the other home prepared it was a 5-bedroom home that we were moving to, and tell me how my mom, how did it all happen? And so she gave him the story how my older sister was 7 years old, she was in a car accident. My mom, she would always come to pick us up and see about us. So, and people were in her ear. You're too overprotective. You need to just let those kids, you know, figure things out on their own, blah, 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 blah. And she said that one day she decided to listen to it. I mean, she was getting her hair done and that feeling. And next thing you know, she gets the phone call because baby girl was trying to cross the street when a crossing guard was not there that day. And that's when the whole tragedy happened. And so she survived that, lived 6 years later, but was mentally, physically impaired. Yeah, so there was a lot going on, and parents, they try to hold on. So she's, by this time, in the bedroom, there's a hospital bed that she's sleeping in. We got bunk beds for the other, for all of us. And the baby was in the crib in their room. It was a lot going on. Anyway, she said she felt something that morning. And she's like, you know, I walked by to check on you guys like I usually do. And she said she noticed that Nikki was not in the bed. And she said, but because my older sister now used to take her, because they were like best friends, and put her in the bed with her. She's like, that's what she thought had gone down. So then she went to go back to bed, and she realized she couldn't sleep. So she gets back up, and she walks in there, and she sees my sister's neck caught on to the bunk bed. So somehow she had fallen off. She had a seizure, because she had epilepsy, and so she had her neck had gotten caught on to the And Dad, when he retrieved her, that's when she took her last breath.
Oh, your poor mother.
Yeah.
So, are you saying that you wrote a play about your mother's experience?
I actually wrote it. I started off as a television episodic, and it was called Through the Eyes. And it never materialized into an actual television episodic. So I'm like, you know, but this is a good story. So I put it in play form. It moved the room.
Okay, so how did you get involved with West Coast Black Theater Troupe?
Another one I was a little interested in.
Of course, I'm not surprised.
One of my friends I worked with in college, she and I had great chemistry on stage. We did a lot of work together. It was amazing. So we always remembered each other. Mm-hmm. Erica Sutherland, she's actually a director in Tampa doing work there. Mm-hmm. And so she called me and she said, Joel, I'm able to do my movie, you know, and so I want you to audition for one of the parts. And I booked the job. I did it. They were impressed. One of the guys, the leading guy that was in the show, was friends with Nate. And he said, you got to come on stage. You got to see this guy. Nate came down, and a small conversation was created from there. I think it was just a follow-up afterwards. The next thing you know, when Applebee's and I'm auditioning in his car. So I'm like, oh, man. And then after that, he said, you know, I got something in mind for you. I'll let you know when it comes up. And that's exactly what happened. Knocked me a kiss. Mm-hmm. And he said the story was, he was talking to Chuck. And Chuck was needing a guy for this particular role. He said, I think I got the guy for you. And he said, Joel, will you do a submission, send something? They said, no, I'm back here at West Coast Black Theater. And so after West Coast, after doing that first show, it was that thing. People kept saying, who is that guy? Who is that guy? You know, so it became a conversation. And Nate started asking me, who are you? You know, what is it that you want to do? And all of that. And I said, you know what? I really enjoyed this performing thing. But what I've known for now, that like the past 10 years, is producing, directing, and writing more than anything. And because most of my acting was attributed to film and television, independent, industrial films, print work, all that kind of stuff. I did maybe one. it's a funny story. First play I did, I think it was in 2009. Aside from that, I had done more musicals than anything. Mm-hmm. Black Nativity, Porgy and Bess, and then came this show called Complacency of Silence, where I was which was a play with music, and was talking about the Darfur things that are happening there. So it was I got nominated for an award. What's happening? You know, totally caught me by surprise. I was teaching. Mm-hmm. And one of the teachers had come up, who was also in the show, who had also got nominated as well. She said, hey, guess what? We got nominated. Ooh, I was like, oh, okay, this is great. So then it let me know, okay, you got a keep some things going, right?
Right.
So then, but I had gone back and forth to California, because right now I'm still producing stuff. I'm not really concerned about me. I'm like, let me just plant myself in my shows, and then I'll be fine, you know,
right.
here
right.
and there. But no, then the next project I had was in L.A. It was a newer project, and I was an understudy. I did an audition for the Roby Theater, Sparkling Entertainment, and they loved me. They put me in, let me speak their words exactly. They wanted to hire me. You know, so when they did that, I was so at a crazy point in my life at this point, because nothing is really making sense. Everybody is like saying what they want to do.
Yeah, what you should be doing.
Absolutely, because I got my manager over here who's talking about a producer that wants to put me in a movie. I have my people over here that wants to put me in a play. I have people over here that wants me to write shows. And like, what am I supposed to do with all this?
Yeah,
and
right.
none of it is like lucrative at this point.
Right, right. You know,
except
right.
this one, if I get this
the
one,
movie,
this
right, movie, right, right.
So this didn't materialize anything. This, you know, I'm still waiting on to figure out, like, if someone's going to finally pick this play up.
Right.
And this one over here was like, you know what, you don't sound sure, so let me put you on as an understudy. So now I just forfeited full
right,
pay.
Right, the one thing, right, right, right.
The one certain day, because I called her back, and she's like, Joel, she said, I wasn't sure. It just didn't feel safe. And I was
right.
really appreciative of her honesty, because right. it was an aha moment for me.
You have like, to Joel, be clear.
You got to be clear. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you're not back at home. You don't have the support.
Yeah, you don't have to fall back on.
Absolutely.
Right.
You know, and people don't understand you the same way.
Right.
So you got to come out here as a professional
right.
and commit to it as a professional. If you can't do it, just say, look, these are the things. And I was like, okay, I did it to myself, and I'm getting it. So now I'm like down in the dumps. How do I get myself out of it? I still did the show.
Uh-huh.
You know, but what happened was, and this was, I did perform twice. They had this group of guys that were performing like 3 months. You know, very fine actors, but I wasn't part of their process. So by this time, I get a phone call, Joel, one of the person is you're understudying has an emergency back home. You need to come on in for rehearsal.
Right.
And they expect me to be off book and ready.
Right.
But I'm like, I haven't been to any rehearsals. I don't know any of the blocking. And my process is, allow me to learn the blocking so I can learn my intent.
Right.
So I can, then I will put that to memory. So when I came that day, they were really hard on me, like hard.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, because they had their own rhythm. So I understood what was happening. I went to talk to the director. I said, I am stifling your process. That's the truth. But that's because you guys are in a different phase than I am. So just to let you know, I'll be ready for you by tomorrow. And I mean, it had gotten like very crazy, like, and then this moment of isolation, because like the guys are over here,
yeah,
and
right,
I'm over
and you're
here.
Not right.
So all those insecurities.
Yeah.
So then the next day, I say, you're not going to catch me twice. So I did exactly what my process is.
Mm-hmm.
After I know the blocking, I'm going to learn the words.
Right.
There were, I think, 103 pages. I learned my lines,
mm-hmm.
working up till it was time to rehearsal. So I'm working, I'm getting through this thing, and then there's a moment. I say something to my scene partner, and I pushed him, because my character was in a bit of an aggressive one. I didn't do it the night before, so it took him off guard. So he says, can I use language on him?
Yeah, sure.
He says, fuck you. And because his character is more,
right,
you know, than mine,
right.
than mine, I'm like, okay, this is what we're doing. We're doing a little, you know,
right, right.
ad-libbing here, okay.
Yeah, right, right.
He said, you push me again, and we're going to be fighting up in here. I'm like, what's happening?
Right. This is a play.
Right.
Right.
I'm like, is this really happening? So I'm still investing into the role.
Right,
I'm still
right,
unaware
right.
that this is actually
right,
real.
Right.
And so he says it again. He said, fuck you. You touch me, you push me again, and we'll be fighting. I kept going. And I got on to do my monologue, and I couldn't finish it because it finally hit me.
Yeah, right, right.
That I was just in a real situation.
Right.
And so he took a pause. He took a break. And again, the moment of isolation.
Yeah.
All the guys over
yeah,
here.
Yeah, on his side.
And here.
Right.
And I'm like, but I'm the one that's been offended.
Yeah, right.
I was the one that was offended. But everyone's on his side. So I said, well, Joel, this is how you do it. You got to, like, fight fire with fire. And your fire is They don't know what you really can bring to the table.
Right.
They don't know how to trust you right now. So only thing you do is perform your trust.
Right.
And that's exactly what I did. By the end of that show, they had to be like, hey, man, okay, I didn't know. I said, I know y'all didn't know.
Yeah.
But it's okay that you didn't know. My point is to show you what you didn't know. And I did that. So we're good.
Well, okay. So now, after Real Life, mm-hmm. do you have plans?
I do. Right now, I'm working on a television show that I cannot exactly, you know,
yeah, okay.
disclose at this time. But I will have information, so look out for that. My hope mm-hmm. is that someone will see this story, because the journey of this story is its own story by itself, because when we first did it, someone was like, I'm interested, let's move this show.
So now, are you talking about
Real Life?
Real Life, okay,
yeah.
All right.
I did in 2008 just as a presentation. The guy was like, man, I love this, let's do it. And no. So then I came back in 2010, brought a promoter
mm-hmm.
that was interested in the project, flew them down, put them up, everything. We want you. And actually what they told me, they said, what is it that you need? My people in St. Louis. And I'm like, I don't know about that, because they were in the trenches with me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can give that up. But everyone was like, George, do what you got to do, do what you got to do. So I get there, and she got me writing for some other things, and I'm thinking we're about to get ready to take this thing on tour. It's in the paper. We're on the cover story. They were talking about a 5-city tour, and nothing.
Oh, dear.
So it's like, it was tragic.
Yeah.
But I kept availing myself to these opportunities that were continuously shut down. We did it again in 2012. People were saying, hey, I want it. Then there was...
And here you are again.
And here I am again. And this time... The yes was a follow-through.
Yeah.
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 It was a complete follow-through. And my goal of it is that someone will see it, and it will become this infectious thing, because it's so socially relevant. From my understanding, you know, from the people, and it's not from my perspective, just from my perspective, but from the audience perspective, that
right.
the music is contagious. The content is riveting in the way that the storytelling, so I'm like, hey, if everybody's saying the same
thing, then it must be true. Okay, yeah. I have one more question to
yes.
ask you. Having given a life to this work,
mm-hmm.
is there something you would say about what that's like, what that feels like?
Yeah, because it takes something out of me. You know, it adds something to,
mm-hmm.
but it takes something out.
No like, kidding.
You know, and it's more the physical, spiritual, emotional exhaustion than anything, because you're living in this space of the unknown, and the only thing you can trust is your faith, wherever that lies. You know, the only thing you can. That's why I tell friends of mine, it was like, you know, how do you feel about everything? I feel good. I feel good. I'm good. I'm always good, because I do believe that everything ends good. So my feelings and my emotions are not exactly relevant most times. Sometimes I know it may sound very weird, but I'm numb to a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's not humorous, like, some things just don't get me right away. And when it touches me that way, I have to address it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but no, I'm like, everything is, you know, and I almost wish I was not this aware.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like to be surprised. And God has been surprising me with a lot of things lately. Even this, I feel like it's surreal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is actually happening. A theater company, not just a promoter, but a theater company said, I want to entrust you
yes.
to put whatever this is that you trust mm-hmm. on my stage. And I believe it materializes to something. That's big. Nate Jacobs, that's big. Mm-hmm. Julie Leach, that's big. Thank you. Cy Shelley. I give my love to them, you know, because they said that they were going to do it,
and they did, right?
Yeah.
That's a great place to stop.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Joel.
Yeah, thank you.
As I said in the introduction, The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are, all of who you really are. And as I also suggested, that is not a common occurrence. So many of us are living out some version of ourselves, but not our whole self. So when you listen to somebody like Joel King, what you hear is what is possible. You hear that it is really an option to discover all that you are and to pursue all that you are. So if you feel that you are not experiencing that in your life, that is what psychotherapy is about. And if you'd like to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. That's thelynnshow.com. Up there, you can click on the email tab and send me an email, ask me a question, make a comment, anything. You can get a copy of my book. You can listen to all the shows I have ever done, including this one. You can get me to come and talk to your group or organization. As always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use, something that inspired you. And certainly Joel's interview is inspirational, something that made you laugh, something that made you look forward to seeing real life, which I did see and is extraordinary, something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray, oh, you see my face and figure, I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper, I may have gotten